Good afternoon, everyone. It's Federica with the show So Did You Hear. We're having conversations with movers and shapers who shape our community. So thank you for listening in today. I am joined by some guests who I've had on the air previously, and we are continuing a conversation that I had on the air. I think it was probably back in March or April of this past year, 2021, somewhere around that time. But I am so excited because this is conversation I've been wanting to continue, and it's a subject that is constantly and rapidly evolving, and I just find personally fascinating. So today we're talking about the decriminalization of psilocybin movement, led locally here in Spokane by Decriminalize Spokane. And so I am joined by Mason Lord. He is the chair of Decrim Spokane here locally. And I also am joined by Pat Donahue, local attorney and legal counsel for Decrim Spokane. And we are just going to go and explore some of the topics we talked about last time, including like, what is decriminalization? Just working through all the kind of the legal stuff, which I think a lot of people find confusing. I know I still find it confusing. And then just some updates on the research that is being done on psilocybin use for clinical studies as well as spiritual practice, and just lots of other studies and the implications for what this means for the movement and society in general, and especially from a health and well-being perspective, and how the substance is being studied and the implications of the findings for it's been like potentially very beneficial uses. So thank you guys for joining me today. I'm really excited for the conversation. So,
and for the listeners, this is Mason speaking, and thank you so much, Federica, for the welcome back. It's totally an honor to be here, and really appreciate the opportunity to speak again.
Awesome.
Yeah, and my name's Pat Donahue. Thanks again for having us back. Really excited to be here today. And with everyone's blessing here, what I'd like to do is actually kind of start today's hour with just a couple moments of silence. I know for me it's been a long week and a fast-paced week and a stressful week, so I'd like to invite all of our listeners, wherever they are, and everyone here present in the room today, to just take a couple moments so we can find our breath, find our space where we are. Be present for today's program. So thank you very much for entertaining me with that.
Yeah, thank you. I needed that.
I think we all did.
It's been definitely things have been feeling crazy in general, and I think it's so important to take moments of pause in the day and like acknowledge where you actually are. Like, I'm here, I'm alive, I'm breathing. Because we all tend to really live in our heads, and especially with how just fast life is in today's day and age, and sometimes you forget to just like notice you're here and you're present and like you're okay. So thank you. That's wonderful.
Well, I know Mason and I are both very excited to be here, and I think we'd like to start off today's session talking about recent national developments. Mm-hmm. And the first development we kind of like to touch on is big news from Denver. So, as our listeners may or may not know, Denver was actually the first to decriminalize psilocybin via voter initiative. So the voters got together and said, "Hey, we want to decriminalize this," and that was back in 2019. And part of that initiative established what was called the Psilocybin Policy Review Panel. Now, the purpose of that panel was to go out and to get information and to report to the council, the city council, about any issues specifically regarding Denver's decriminalization efforts. Earlier this month, the panel reported significantly there were no issues regarding Denver's decriminalization of psilocybin. More specifically, the president of the panel, a gentleman named Kevin Matthews, reported, "Decriminalizing psilocybin mushrooms in the city and county of Denver has not created any significant public health or safety issue in the city." Additionally, Matthews said, "Arrests involving psilocybin mushrooms were down 50% compared to before decriminalizing. And of the psilocybin arrests that were made, 89% of them included other illicit substances. So effectively, enforcement of just pure possession of psilocybin mushrooms has effectively dropped to zero in that jurisdiction. Importantly, also, Denver hospitals have no data for emergencies related to mushrooms, and that includes no reports of fatal overdoses and no recorded accounts of someone under the influence of mushrooms injuring or killing someone else. Really cool fact, the panel further asked the city council to actually expand the decriminalization efforts to include the adult gifting of psilocybin, group setting use, and crisis intervention response training.
So that's big news there coming out of Denver to start with. And we were chatting about this earlier. I mean, first of all, I think those stats are just very interesting, especially that there's been no link to hospitalizations or people ending up in harmful situations exclusively because of psilocybin. Now, who knows, there with other substances involved. I think you mentioned there were some cases, folks getting...
For arrests. It sounds like there have been some arrests with other substances based on other substances that have also involved psilocybin.
Gotcha. Okay. But
and that could, you know, specifically be dealers as opposed to users.
Right.
So
that I don't have information on the specifics. But that's interesting. And I think it's really interesting to hear that they're looking at crisis response training. I think that's hugely important because what I think we've noticed let's call it traditional intervention, when, say, if there is some kind of a crisis involving a substance use, somebody is, I don't know, just generically speaking, either, you know, having a bad time because they're of a substance, or, you know, they're in crisis and having a psychological crisis, physical crisis, and the cops respond, you know, traditionally speaking, you know, you hear a lot of discussion around how police force are not have not been properly trained a lot of times into how to properly intervene in these situations, especially something that is a, you know, physical health or mental health crisis. You know, the right response is not necessarily to put the person in handcuffs. Like, so that's huge. I think that's really a big development.
It's great to involve the medical field, but I think that would point towards the opportunity for example, social workers to be trained in harm reduction efforts. That way, you know, medical resources are freed up, where most people who may need help when they're using psilocybin are actually dealing with like a mental health crisis as opposed to an actual physical one. So it's great that the first responders are going to be trained in this, but it also opens the doors for other avenues like social workers who might be better fit for like allocating community resources to be in charge of that as opposed to the first responders. So I think that's a cool thing.
Exactly, Mason. And I think a good way to describe this is, you know, perhaps what we're seeing here is an end to the incarceration model of, you know, substance use and substance abuse, and, you know, perhaps the dawn of a more compassionate day, where instead of fear and prejudice driving our decisions, we're being led more by science and data. And what the science and data is showing out of Denver, certainly, is that psilocybin as a molecule appears to be extremely safe and is not causing significant disruptions.
Yeah, I'm so glad you bring up that point. As we're looking at these models and these stats, you know, it's important to discuss what are the implications of what we're observing. And I think it just reflects maybe a shift in culture, which probably, you know, starts with how we view substance use in general, and not only how we respond to it on a legal side, but just in in general in society. How do we create a more realistic and healthy relationship in view of just different substances and how or what our relationships as humans are to mind altering substances. And yeah, of course, traditionally war on drugs era model and the traditional viewpoint and stigma has been pretty negative. It doesn't leave a lot of room for I guess compassionate response to people who need help and have generally maybe seen struggle with things like addiction and use, but it also is kept a lot of doors closed for researching and looking into beneficial uses of substances. And so I think I agree that this is a kind of the implication of that finding, that there could be a lot of that could be a big movement in the in another direction, the implications of this Denver study. So I find that's very interesting. And yeah, is there anything else you want to discuss with the Denver situation, or what we know, how do we expand from here?
Well, and I think the way to expand is, you know, we have more than 50 years of information now showing that the incarceration model and Just Say No has failed us horribly.
I'm thinking of a meme. It says, congratulations to drugs to winning the war on drugs.
and failing at this point, you know, probably two generations of Americans, or close to two generations, coming up on two generations of Americans.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think it's a bit of a tightrope to walk, because on one hand, we need to stop the incarceration model, and in my opinion, as soon as possible. But on the other hand, we want to proceed carefully. You know, we want to proceed intelligently, and we want to be informed by science and information and data. But at the same time, we need to get going in that direction, and it's nice to see that steps are being taken.
Mm-hmm.
And definitely interesting to, you know, point out that with the, you know, initial psychedelic revolution related to counterculture back in the 60s, we have are very aware of how that delved into sort of a sense of madness and maybe just not coherence, and be with the you know, evolution of our society kind of bringing psychedelics back into the periphery of, hey, there's a lot of potential here for positive outcomes, and we can look to the past to see what not to do here moving forward. So I think it's definitely great that we have an opportunity here to open people's minds and, you know, also potentially provide healing.
And this may be a good kind of jumping off point to get into the other two headlines from the news recently here. As a brief detour, what we were just discussing was Denver's decriminalization efforts.
Yes.
And for the listeners, there's a difference between decriminalization, legalization, and religious use. These are sort of three separate silos.
Mm-hmm.
What Denver did was they decriminalized. They basically directed their police force to stop arresting individuals for possession of psilocybin. They did not create any sort of regulatory framework where a consumer of psilocybin could go into a regulated storefront and make informed purchases.
Mm-hmm.
The sort of psilocybin economy or psilocybin ecosystem in Denver is still very much unregulated and underground.
Mm-hmm.
In contrast to that, where on the state level and here in Washington and in Oregon has begun implementing a more regulatory framework of legalization, where there's a robust regulatory agency, where there are established storefronts, there are testing procedures, and these following two studies kind of have to do more with a more regulated and controlled environment or studies and look into how these molecules work and affect people, as opposed to just directing the police force to stop arresting.
Mm-hmm.
They both come from Johns Hopkins. If the listeners remember, back in 2016, the researchers at Johns Hopkins studied the effects of psilocybin on people with a life-threatening cancer diagnosis and found that it significantly relieved anxiety and depression in those individuals. Mm. Again, that was back in 2016. That study, in conjunction with Michael Pollan's book, How to Change Your Mind, in 2018, really got the ball rolling on what I hear has been called sort of the third wave of the psychedelic renaissance. Mm. Hot off the presses, November 4th of 2021, Johns Hopkins published its findings from a small study of psilocybin on individuals with major depressive disorder. Now, major depressive disorder, that means an individual with persistently depressed mood and long-term loss of pleasure or interest in life. A terrible struggle. It's often combined with other symptoms such as disturbed sleep, feelings of guilt, feelings of inadequacy, suicidal thoughts. So these are the individuals that Johns Hopkins was studying the effects of psilocybin on. And their randomized clinical trial found that psilocybin-assisted therapy, get this, produced large, rapid, and sustained antidepressant effects in patients with major depressive disorder. This is huge. Mm. Dr. Alan Davis said the magnitude of the effect they saw was about four times larger than what clinical trials have shown for traditional antidepressants on the market.
That's impressive. That's huge. That's huge.
And to dovetail off of that, the study that Pat spoke towards was in 2016, and then the most recent one this year in 2021. But I do want to point out a study that was done in 2006 that was published in Psychopharmacology. So this is actually something that listeners can look up on Google Scholar. But the title of the study is "Psilocybin Can Occasion Mystical Type Experiences Having Substantial and Sustained Personal Meaning and Spiritual Significance," which kind of makes sense why they're finding that people with major depressive disorder are, you know, benefiting from the use of psilocybin. And again, that was a study done in 2006, so 10 years prior to the first one that Pat just brought up. So it actually has been being researched for well over a decade, that this potential is there, and it seems like we're just getting confirmation on that, which is really awesome.
Yeah, that's to me absolutely fascinating. This is where I know, like, my personal interest in this subject with any kind of substances that, you know, we wouldn't traditionally consider, quote unquote, traditionally consider, but air quotes, medicine, is being spewed in a whole new way, and it's not just kind of woo-woo talk. Like, these are real hard facts. This is actual clinical studies. So let's talk a little bit about these studies. I'd really like to kind of dig around a little bit. And you mentioned that the most recent study showed, what was it, four times more. Do you read that stat again real quick?
Sure. The effect they saw was about four times larger than what clinical trials have shown for traditional antidepressants.
So, yeah, I'd love to know more, like, specifically, what did the study look like? How did they set it up? And so when we're talking about traditional antidepressant treatment, so I think we're talking about like SSRIs, traditional antidepressants, Prozac,
Correct. I think the big thing to mention, the big thing to emphasize in this, is that these studies don't just give someone psilocybin and say, "I hope you feel better" or "best of luck."
Mm-hmm.
These involve preparation sessions, before the preparation session, these individuals are screened. And then they are given preparation sessions where they're basically begin working with therapists and counselors before the actual session.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of hard work goes into that, both with the therapist and the provider and the patient. Then there is at least one, and sometimes many, or sometimes several, actual sessions where the individual ingests the psilocybin and has the psilocybin experience. And then critically, there are also follow-up or integration sessions. And from everything I'm kind of seeing, it appears that the real benefits from these molecules are in the psilocybin-assisted therapy, that the psilocybin helps the therapy, and that the therapy really is an intrinsic sort of part of the improvements that we're seeing and can't be separated from it.
And just to bring up another study that was also done in the Journal of Psychopharmacology, follow-up to the last one I brought up. So this one took place in 2008. And to emphasize that the title, it says, Mystical Type Experiences Occasioned by Psilocybin Mediate the Attribution of Personal Meaning and Spiritual Significance 14 months later. So that, you know, really brings up the idea of you know, doing follow-up integration work, and how specifically I emphasized mystical type experiences, because that shows that it's not the psilocybin that's necessarily actually providing the healing for these individuals. It's actually the experience itself. So the preparation work, the integration work, that all is going to help provide what would be considered a mystical type experience, because there is an actual criteria that you have to meet to actually have a mystical experience. It's not just a broad term. There is a way that they can actually figure out, hey, does this, you know, can we check off enough boxes here that would call this a mystical experience? So I think just important to bring that up as well, because it really just relates to what Pat was just discussing. So.
Yeah. And I think in terms of the preparation and integration, there's an important, and I guess to put it more explicitly, a harm reduction aspect that would come with legalization, and that is absent from a decriminalization model. Again, with the decriminalization model, you're just telling the police stop arresting people, but the average individual doesn't have any more or less access to information than they do under prohibition. And these are potent molecules, and they're powerful molecules. And there's the potential for people to have very difficult times. And I think it's important, as we begin to explore how these molecules can integrate into our society or be reintegrated into society, that we make sure that they're done, you know, safely, and in a responsible manner. I know also there are some companies, and I'm not terribly familiar with this, but there are some companies who are trying to develop, I suppose they'd be analogs of these molecules, where they're trying to get the same antidepressant effects without the sort of psychedelic experience. And I don't have enough information to have a really informed opinion on that. However, I know there are a number of prominent researchers who believe that the sort of psychedelic experience in conjunction with the therapy is necessary, is sort of part and parcel for these improvements that we're seeing. But there are individuals out there who are looking to see if these benefits can be divorced from that experience.
And I can just say that we can thank DARPA for creating these analogs initially. So,
but it's, in any event, it's I'm excited by that line of research, and I'm excited to see what it shows, and I'm looking forward to seeing the data out there. And I hope that one day the data supports allowing responsible adults to make these decisions in an informed, controlled, and safe context.
Yeah, absolutely. So there's a little bit I want to speak on as well, from what I've just, everything I've heard, and just for clarity's sake. So when you're looking at these studies, you're touching on mental health, and when you're observing the treatment of any kind of mental health condition, there's a lot of variables. And so I think it's important to emphasize, as you did, this is it's called psilocybin assisted therapy. So basically, this doesn't mean like it's it's not like giving somebody a magic pill saying, you know, if you're feeling depressed, you take this substance and you're going to be cured. Like, it doesn't work like that.
You also don't take it home with you for continued use after your session.
Right. Okay. So,
so it's not prescribed, given to you in a bottle, and then, you know, you're taking a daily dose. It's much different than that.
Right. So it looks very different from, say, that, the, like, if you're using traditional treatment for depression, you're prescribed an SSRI, and that works. First of all, the way that the substance, like the way we're looking at the substance use, looks different. So, like you said, you're not taking a pill every day. That changes your brain chemistry to make you feel better. This looks, or it's, I don't, supposed to make you feel better. It's not a chemical imbalance based approach. It's an approach that is actually looking at treating the person's psychological condition. So, from an experiential point of view, rather than like a chemical, if that makes sense. So you're the therapy itself is kind of the treatment, rather than like the drug altering your brain chemistry.
Which would be like, you know, reprocessing your neural pathways,
yes,
more or
yes.
less. So it's more of a permanent result that is like coming from within your body. These neural pathways are changing, so you don't need a consistent chemical to provide that. It's mm-hmm. really something that you know, is initiated by the experience and then allows you to retrain your brain, more or less. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's something called neuroplasticity, which pretty much shows that our brains are plastic. So the saying, you can't teach an old dog new tricks, just isn't true.
Mm-hmm.
You absolutely can retrain your brain. And, you know, it's just amazing to think that this is a tool that could help somebody do this within their own body without needing the exogenous chemical to mm-hmm. provide that for them.
Well, and, right. and one very significant challenge that comes along with this is the fact that these studies and the tools that this emerging psychedelic ecosystem are using involve a lot of time.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a 15-minute doctor's appointment where you're in and out and then you get a script and you run to your pharmacy and you pop a pill a couple times a day. I mean, these are taking, you know, several lengthy, again, preparation sessions. The experience itself lasts 5 to 6 hours. That's a significant time commitment, and then the integration sessions as well. And so a challenge that's appearing as this ecosystem continues to develop is, how do we ensure that is accessible and affordable to every part of our society and not just the super affluent and the super wealthy
mm-hmm.
Who can afford to do this? And this may be a good time to kind of touch upon the Oregon psilocybin model and what's sort of going on there and what's developing there, and a slightly different approach that we're looking to take on the state level here in Washington.
Okay.
In Oregon, there is only one type of provider. There's only one level, as of now, only one level of psilocybin provider. So that means, and critically, the requirements for this are minimal. You're going to have to take and pass their training. But in terms of educational, it's just a high school diploma or a GED.
Mm.
You don't need to be a doctor. You don't need to have any advanced degrees. You don't even need to graduate from college to be a psilocybin provider in Oregon.
Mm.
The challenge that's going to come with that, however, is there's no differentiation between a doctor, a medical doctor who's able to diagnose and treat, you know, medical conditions and more of a trip sitter.
Uh-huh.
Or an individual who may have a more shamanistic background. And kind of in between that, you know, say a counselor or a mental health or a chemical dependency expert.
Mm-hmm.
And so what we're looking to do in Washington is develop a model that has tiers of providers. And as of now, we're looking at three tiers of providers. On one extreme end, someone who's like a certified registered nurse anesthetist or a doctor, someone with an advanced medical degree, who again would be able to diagnose and treat medical conditions. Someone in the first tier who again, just has a perhaps a high school diploma or GED, and then individuals in the middle that may have mental health or chemical dependency training and fall somewhere in between those. And the hope is that this would sort of open up an opportunity for individuals who may not be able to afford the time of a doctor to seek out adult psilocybin services in an informed way, to not be going, for instance, to a shaman under the impression that they're going to be diagnosed and treated for a medical condition.
That's hugely important. That's and it's important to acknowledge that, you know, even as we move towards decriminalizing substances and integrating them, we need to create spaces for people to accurately and most beneficially use those substances. And so building structure into that model that's huge. Not only so folks can get like the most benefit out of the treatment, but also so that it is more accessible. Because I think let's talk a little bit about accessibility, because I think here in Washington, at least now, we're moving closer to integrating, hopefully, these models. Maybe, well, let's hope. I don't know what kind of timeline you would put on this, but we're probably a lot further along than, say, some other states where it's just still completely illegal, and you can't even folks can't even access this type of treatment in certain parts of the country. So, if I'm somebody who's interested, in learning about, if I would, I have, treatment-resistant depression, and I'm interested in knowing how do I qualify for these treatments, where can I find information about where I can access it? How would I approach it?
So I can't expose too much related to that at the moment, but I will say that with individuals involved in the statewide effort, specifically the Entheo Society of Washington, there has been discussion on a great way to provide resources for folks. And I really am not going to go any further there, but I can just say that in the future that we will be announcing some great ways for people to provide to access information on that.
In a safe and legal and controlled context. I think this actually is a good launching point for the another thing I wanted to discuss was a future study from Johns Hopkins that has to do with smoking cessations for people who want to stop smoking. So it was just recently announced the National Institutes of Health granted Johns Hopkins Medicine $4 million to investigate if psilocybin can help people quit smoking. And so, if you want legal access to these molecules, you have to get involved with a legitimate study at this point.
And one legitimate study from 2014 that took place, it's also on Google Scholar, NIH.gov is where the HTML comes from, and that is psilocybin-occasioned mystical experiences in the treatment of tobacco addiction. So again, going back to the mystical experience being a primary role player in helping people.
That's very interesting. If I can just say so, that I think when you're talking about addiction treatment, I'm really curious to know the details. Is maybe why it's how it's effective and how it why it's effective, because I think with it's, with addiction, when you have a sort of a chemical dependency or of some on some degree or another to a substance, and it's very interesting to see, just from a neurochemical standpoint, how that works, how it's able to create these therapies that are able to create that change in folks struggling with addiction.
And I think addiction at its core, I mean, its continued use despite adverse consequences is sort of a definition of it, but at its core, it's a deeply ingrained habit that is harming the individual. And we're still discovering a lot about exactly how these molecules work on the brain, but I think one thing these molecules allow people to do is to establish new connections and new pathways in their brain. Mm. In his book, in Michael Pollan's book, he discusses the idea that, I believe in, this is kind of a brief summary, but to imagine your brain like a hill that's covered in snow. And, you know, you start off and you climb to the top of the hill and you sled down one direction. Mm-hmm. And it kind of establishes, you know, a path down. And as we grow older, these pathways become more and more firmly established. So it's harder for us to jump out and to find a new path. And that these psychedelic compounds essentially allow us to put a whole bunch of new snow on that hill. So we're free to go down in whatever direction we want. Or whatever direction we're taken during the course of the experience. And perhaps it's that freedom or increased view of possibilities that allows individuals to sort of see another way of existing.
Mm. I think that's fascinating.
And so that's almost like, you know, if you had a flexible flyer sled with rusty, you know, rusty runners on it, and you polish it up and it's brand new and, you know, slices through that snow very cleanly, like, you know, maybe just another analogy for how make it a little bit easier to navigate that snowy hill. So.
Well, and it's interesting too that the National Institutes of Health are getting on board with this, because they're the primary federal agency for conducting and supporting medical research, and so I'm excited to see that they're taking, you know, the potential for these compounds seriously, because I think in addition to, you know, as we discussed, or as we were kind of discussing, cracking open some of these doors, it's showing that medical research into this field is legitimate, and it's no longer really considered career suicide as it once mm-hmm. was, and a lot of the stigma around these molecules is starting to lift, which I'm deeply excited about. There are many individuals out there who have encountered these molecules in the wild, for lack of a better term, and had profound and incredibly positive life-changing experiences, but because of the social or professional stigma, they've been sort of unwilling to talk about or to share, and it seems like that veil is starting to lift.
And I just want to point out that to me it's just very interesting that there are these studies that show a substance which is currently illegal can help people stop ingesting legal substances, you know. So this other study from 2015, psilocybin-assisted treatment for alcohol dependence, a proof of concept study, also published in the Journal of Psychopharmacology on Google Scholar. I mean, going back to, you know, these studies that are being done to help people quit smoking. So just, like, wrap your mind around that. We're doing studies to using an illegal substance to help people stop ingesting legal ones.
Well, you know, the ridiculousness is everywhere, especially considering the fact that, you know, primarily on the west side of the state, but all over the state, fungus containing these molecules grows naturally. Mm. You know, in the yards of individuals, you know, on campuses, all over the place, and this naturally occurring, apparently profoundly helpful molecule has been. We've been prohibited from accessing it and from experimenting with it, despite, you know, thousands of years of safe use in many traditional cultures.
Mm-hmm. And so, how about in the past week?
Well, so the one thing I would like to also mention is this. We do need to be careful as we proceed down this path. Compass Pathways just this last week released some good news that comes with information we should be aware of. So they conducted the largest controlled double-blind phase 2 study. And so the good news is they took individuals who had treatment-resistant depression. So these are people who had tried two or more traditional prior medications for depression, and they'd failed to find relief. And in this study, which wasn't published in a peer-reviewed journal that I'm aware of, but it found that nearly a quarter of the individuals treated with the highest dose of psilocybin saw the severity of their depression reduced. Mm-hmm. So of these individuals, a quarter of whom took the, or of the individuals who took the high dose, 25% of them found relief from psilocybin when they tried at least two other methods and not found relief.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's the good news. The challenge is ahead, though. Of that study, about 5% of people exhibited suicidal behavior or thoughts or showed intent to harm themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So 5% is not a lot, but we're talking about humans. Like, we're talking about human lives. Everyone is incredibly important.
Mm-hmm.
Now, 5% of people in the study to exhibit that behavior is not necessarily surprising, given the fact that the study deals with patients with treatment-resistant depression.
Mm-hmm.
But it's important to note that of the individuals who exhibited this behavior, about 66% of them didn't respond to the treatment.
The psilocybin.
Correct. Yeah.
So these are people who already were not responding to other treatments. This treatment didn't work either. And this was basically another treatment that didn't work out for those folks.
It suggests, I don't think we can say conclusively, but it suggests that this was more of an effect of the underlying condition and the fact that the psilocybin had failed to help them mm-hmm. than necessarily caused by the psilocybin.
Oh, yeah. I think, that's exactly kind of the caveat I kind of wanted to bring up with that study. My thoughts were just that, maybe these folks already had suicidal thoughts going into the study. I don't know if we have that information available from the study, but I think any kind of study, there are always going to be a lot of variables, kind of like I mentioned earlier, and I think this one, it's important to note. We don't necessarily know from what this study is suggesting, like what causes what. There's no way to suggest that it was like the treatment caused suicidal ideation, or was that actually just something that the person, these folks were already prone to, maybe were already struggling with going into the study.
I just want to point out that it is known that when an individual takes an SSRI for depression,
mm-hmm.
that when they go off of the medication, let's say they just decide to stop taking it one day, it is rather common for them to wind up having suicidal or homicidal ideology.
Mm-hmm.
And that's actually led to some rather severe extreme cases of, harm being done to other individuals besides the person taking the medication. So that is a current medication being used in the mental health field, these SSRIs. And I know for a fact it's a larger percentage than 5% for people who stop taking the SSRIs. It's rather common that they can wind up with these harmful tendencies towards themselves or others.
Yeah, or I've even heard stories about folks whose suicidal thoughts get worse. I mean, you read in if you're thinking about even like the drug ads or informational mm-hmm. pamphlets, that they tell you like these substances may actually worsen those traits in some people. So it's really there's a lot of kind of ambiguity as far as understanding the correlation and relationship between the medicine and the person having these ideation, suicidal ideation, changes in thoughts and moods. I think we just have to take some ambiguity into that context there, and just know that there's going to be a little bit of, a little bit of direct correlation we don't fully understand maybe yet.
Well, and again, sounding like a broken record, which I'm fine with, but in my opinion, emphasizes the importance of, bringing this out into the light of day,
mm-hmm.
into having an established regulatory framework where informed consumers can make informed decisions about how they want to proceed in a safe context, in a context that's there to support them in the event they fall in what appears to be an extreme minority of individuals who have challenging experiences.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And so these are there, how many of these studies are like being conducted now approximately, if we have a kind of a ballpark as to how the field overall is evolving?
Oh, I don't have the number of studies. Maybe Mason can pull it up. I know if I recall seeing a graph that where it's just exploding off the charts if you look for a number of studies involving, you know, psilocybin, mm-hmm. LSD, things like that, from a handful, you know, 30 years ago to certainly, I believe, dozens now, if not more.
Mm-hmm.
And I know Compass Pathways, for instance, is planning on moving on to phase 3 studies, where the drug is given to large groups of people. And significantly, under phase 3, it's to confirm the drug's efficacy, to confirm, to basically say, okay, so we have established this as a breakthrough therapy, that we've established it's helpful. We want to confirm that it's helpful, and we want to confirm its safety.
Mm-hmm.
So the important thing is, before a drug gets to phase 3, there's lots of indications that it's helpful and safe. And this is just sort of a, again, given to a large group of people to look to see how it affects large populations as opposed to several hundred.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I just think, you know, the more of these studies that are conducted, the more we will know and the better we will understand the facts, and we'll be able to fully, yeah, understand how it works. And I guess that's a cycle. The more we know about these substances and how they work, then, you know, the more we can maybe work on mainstreaming and under controlled environments and informed settings, continue to integrate them into society. And the more than that happens, and then the more we find out, and it's kind of about how they work. And it's a cycle that was like, once it gets started, will reinforce itself. But yeah, I think so. Just.
And so just to relate back to how many studies are going on, I just want to mention on HopkinsMedicine.org, so that's Johns Hopkins University, there is something called the Johns Hopkins Center for Psychedelic and Consciousness Research. It's leading the way in exploring innovative treatments using psilocybin. The molecular structure of psilocybin, a naturally occurring psychedelic compound found in magic mushrooms, allows it to penetrate the central nervous system, and the scientific and medical experts are just beginning to understand its effects on the brain and mind and its potential as therapeutics for mental illness. And backed by $17 million of funding, research are building on previous work and expanding research on psychedelics for illness and wellness.
Wow.
So rather than an actual number of studies being involved, there's actually a Center for Psychedelic and Consciousness Research at Johns Hopkins University.
Well, that's pretty significant. I think in and of itself, I think, as a well-renowned institute like Johns Hopkins, and that's no joke.
Yeah.
So,
and a number of others. And also kind of the tying in, Federico, with what you mentioned is, this is also sort of in the, this is, our discussion has been primarily in the context of Western medicine.
Yes.
In this context is basically in like a very American and very Western, like as in West Coast of the United States, approach to these substances.
Mm.
I think it's important to remember that the religious use of these molecules, you know, dates back as far as we can peer in history. And I believe that the religious, the genuine religious use of these molecules is protected both by the First Amendment of our federal constitution and Article 1, Section 11 of the Washington State Constitution. Now, with the caveat again that usage is not going to be, it's going to appeal to a different type of individual, and I think it's important that both of these ecosystems flourish and grow together.
Mm-hmm.
Because an individual who's more comfortable with a traditional sort of shamanistic approach to this may not be interested in a clinical model.
Mm-hmm.
And conversely, there's a lot of individuals out there who aren't going to want or aren't going to be comfortable in a more shamanistic model and are going to want a more clinical approach to this, and they're going to be comforted by studies and people in lab coats. But I think it's important to not lose sight of, again, the safety, the apparent incredible safety of these molecules in conjunction with their long-standing historical use. And as we move forward to try to respect that tradition and to honor that tradition and to allow as much as we possibly can that tradition to flourish and survive in conjunction and sort of hand in hand with the clinical model.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's a great thing to mention as well, because, you know, like you mentioned, maybe some folks will find that using the substance in a spiritual way may be more helpful to them, and there should be, you know, space allowed for people to have experiences of that kind as well. Like, it doesn't necessarily have to be like you said, a lab coat prescribed sort of Western approach to the treatment.
However, I just want to also mention that, like, you know, so these studies that have been done, published in the Journal of Psychopharmacology, again, another one from 2011, mystical experiences occasioned by the hallucinogen psilocybin lead to increases in the personality domain of openness, also available on Google Scholar. This study would have been done in a clinical setting.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't necessarily need to separate the potential for a spiritual experience outside of the clinics. Certainly some people may have access to that more so in a shamanistic or religious environment, but just because it's being done in a clinic doesn't mean that it's not going to have some spiritual effects as well.
Right, or say vice versa.
Right.
They're just pushing us to rethink how we define the line between, like, spiritualism and medicine in the Western context, and that maybe, you know, these things aren't necessarily all mutually exclusive. In fact, there's, like, as you're saying, a lot of evidence to suggest otherwise, which I think is also great to acknowledge and something interesting is how we learn about, like, ourselves as humans and how we evolve and heal, and there's many avenues towards that. And so I guess these substances can be an asset in all manners of that healing. So I think we have just a few minutes left, I just want to leave it to you guys to announce if there's anything else, any other studies or developments that are happening that you wanted to share, things we should be looking or can be looking out for locally, nationally, etc.
So I think it'd be a good opportunity to share that Decriminalize Spokane, we're beginning to shift our focus more on the state level to support an organization called ADAPT, ADAPT. It's Addiction, Depression, Anxiety, Psilocybin Treatment. And ADAPT is the group that in about 6 weeks we're going to be filing a voter initiative that will establish a robust regulatory framework on the state level for these services, very similar to what Oregon did with 109. We need about touch over 300,000 signatures by July. We're going to start gathering signatures here shortly into the new year. And unlike the decriminalization effort here locally that would just only affect local officers and their policing, this would be, again, a statewide effort that would establish a very detailed procedure and sort of regulatory framework for individuals seeking more information or perhaps an experience with these molecules, a safe avenue to do so. And anyone curious about that should follow ADAPT, ADAPT, on Instagram and Facebook. And Decriminalize Spokane will, I believe, continue to put out information about ADAPT.
Mm-hmm. And do we have plans to do something on the local level as well?
We're gonna continue pushing for decriminalization on the local level, for sure. But the support and effort that's going to be needed on the state level, especially on the east side of this state, is going to take a lot of time, and it's going to take a lot of resources, and so a lot of efforts are going to be focused more on the top down approach from the state as opposed to the city up.
And resources are rather scant, I might want to point out. So we do have a fundraising event going on for ADAPT December 7th. That's going to be at Daybreakers out in Seattle. And you can find out more about that event on the ADAPT Facebook page and website adapt.org, I believe, as well, is a great place to learn more about what we have going on there.
Fantastic.
And anyone interested in volunteering their time also would be greatly appreciated to reach out to either ADAPT or Decriminalize Spokane. We're happy for any help we can get, and anyone willing to donate their most valuable resource, their time.
And the best way to say contact would be sort of like through social media or your websites?
Through Instagram, probably through Instagram and Facebook.
Fantastic.
And if there's a delayed response from us and you're reaching out to us, you know, like I said, we are scant on resources, so please don't feel like we're ignoring you. Feel free to keep reaching out. We're not going to be bothered by that. So we will respond to you as soon as we can. Just please be aware that we are very busy with our lives, and we will get to all messages when we can, and we just don't want to make sure that you don't feel like we're trying to leave you out intentionally.
Fantastic. Well, thank you guys so much for sharing your resources and for this fantastic conversation today. I really appreciate you guys for offering your time and keeping the conversation going. For listeners, if you were interested in listening to the past episode, you can find it on kyrs.org/sodidyouhear. Under the program playlist, I have a full playlist of previous episodes, which I'm constantly adding to. But so previous episodes going back to, I think, like early March of last year or February are all in there, so you can find that previous episode. Again, that's at kyrs.org/sodidyouhear. Thanks, everybody.